into words I could understand. And I had the sense that they were words I knew with my blood, not my ears.
Good evening. I congratulate you.
At this, my father seemed to come to life again. I don't know how he found the strength to speak. His voice trembled with fear and fury.
Where is she?
You have been the most determined of them all. Come with me, and I will give you knowledge for 10,000 lifetimes.
No! I didn't know how I could understand him, but I thought he was calling out to my father. I was so terrified at having actually spoken to that figure that I felt my consciousness sway inside me for a moment. I had the sense that the presence before us might be smiling, although his face was in darkness again.
Come with me, or let your daughter come.
What?
My father spoke to me almost inaudibly. It was at this moment that I knew he could not understand Dracula's words, and perhaps could not even hear Dracula. My father was answering my cry. The figure appeared to think for a while in silence. He shifted his very real boots on the stone. There was something not only gruesome about his shape under the ancient clothes, but also graceful, an old habit of power.
I have waited a long time for a scholar of your gifts.
The voice was soft now, and infinitely dangerous. We stood in a darkness that seemed to flood us from that dark figure.
Come with me, of your own volition.
Now my father seemed to lean toward him a little, his grip still on my arm. What he couldn't understand, he could apparently feel. Dracula's shoulder twitched. He shifted his terrible weight from one leg to another. The presence of his body was like the actual presence of death, and yet he was alive and moving.
Do not keep me waiting. If you will not come, I will come for you.
Now my father seemed to gather all of his strength.
Where is she? Where is Helen?
The figure rose up, and I saw an angry gleam of teeth, bone, eye, the shadow of the hood swinging over his face again, his inhuman hand clenching at the margin of the light. I had the terrible sense of an animal crouched to pounce, of a leaping toward us, even before he moved. And then there was a footfall on the shadowy stair behind him, and a flash of motion that we felt in the air because we could not see it. I raised the lantern with a scream that seemed to me to come from outside myself, and I saw Dracula's face, which I can never forget. And then, to my utter astonishment, I saw another figure standing just behind him. The second person had apparently just come down the stairs, a dark and inchoate form like his but bulkier, the outline of a living man. The man was moving rapidly, and he had something bright in his raised hand. But Dracula had sensed his presence already and turned with his arm out and pushed the man away. Dracula's strength must have been prodigious because suddenly the powerful human figure collided with the crypt wall. We heard a silent thud, then a groan. Dracula was turning this way and that in a kind of horrible distraction, first for us and then toward the groaning man. Suddenly, there was again the sound of footsteps on the stairs. Light ones this time, accompanied by the beam of a strong flashlight. Dracula had been caught off balance. He turned too late, a blur of darkness. Someone searched the scene swiftly with the light, raised an arm, and fired once. Dracula did not move as I'd expected a moment earlier, hurtling over the sarcophagus toward us. Instead, he was falling, first backward so that his chiseled, pale face surfaced again for a moment. And then forward and forward until there was a thud on the stone, a breaking sound like flung bone. He lay convulsed for a second, and at last was still. Then his body seemed to be turning to dust, to nothing, even his ancient clothes decaying around him there in the confusing light. My father dropped my arm and ran toward the flashlight's beam skirting the mass on the floor.
Helen!
But Barley was pushing forward, too, and he had caught up my father's lantern. A large man lay on the flagstones, his dagger beside him.
Oh, Elsie.
His head oozed a little dark blood, and even as we watched in paralyzing horror, his eyes grew still. Barley threw himself into the dust next to that shattered form. He seemed to be actually strangling with surprise and grief.
Master James!
The hotel in Les Bains boasted a high-ceilinged parlor with a fireplace, and the maitre d' had lit a fire there and stubbornly closed the parlor doors against the other guests. He set a bottle of cognac near my father.
Your trip to the monastery has tired you.
The maitre d' had been on the phone all evening, and he had somehow made things right with the police. Now that everyone official was gone, I sat on the uncomfortable damask sofa with Helen, who reached over to stroke my hair every few minutes and tried not to imagine Master James's kind face and solid form inert under a sheet. My father sat in a deep chair by the fire and gazed at her, at us. Barley had put his long legs up on an ottoman and was trying, I thought, not to stare at the cognac until my father recollected himself and poured us each a glass. Barley's eyes were red with silent weeping. My father looked across at Barley, and I thought for a moment that he was going to cry, too.
He was very brave. You know that his attack made it possible for Helen to shoot as she did.
Barley nodded, still unable to speak, and there was a little silence among us. At last, Helen set down her glass.
I promised I would tell you everything when we could sit quietly.
You're sure you wouldn't like me to leave you alone?
Helen laughed, and I was surprised by the melody of her laugh, so different from her speaking voice. Even in that room half full of grief, her laugh did not seem out of place.
No, no, my dear. We can't do without you.
I loved her accent, that harsh yet sweet English of hers, that I thought I already knew from so long ago I couldn't remember the time.
Telling will take a long, long time, but I can say a few things now at least. First, that I am sorry. I have caused you such pain, Paul, I know.
She looked at my father across the firelight. Barley stirred, embarrassed, but she stopped him with a firm gesture.
Also, I am alive, not undead. He never reached me a third time.
I wanted to look at my father, but I couldn't bring myself even to turn my head. It was his private moment. I heard, though, that he did not sob aloud. She stopped and seemed to draw a breath.
Paul, when we visited Saint-Mathieu, and I learned about their traditions, the abbot who had raised from the dead, and Brother Kirill who guarded him, I was filled with despair, and also with a terrible curiosity.
She paused to stroke my cheek and to take my hand in hers.
When I heard Brother Kirill's explanation of the legend at Saint-Mathieu, I felt that I would never be able to rest until I knew more. I believed that if I could find Dracula and exterminate him, I might be completely well again. A good mother. A person with a new life. After you fell asleep, Paul, I went out to the cloisters. I had considered going into the crypt again with my gun, trying to open the sarcophagus, but I thought I could not do it alone. While I was trying to decide whether or not to wake you, to beg you to help me, I sat on the cloister bench looking over the cliff.
Helen's eyes had grown strangely wide.
As I sat there, I felt the crawling of a skin on my back, as if something stood just behind me. I turned quickly, and on the other side of the cloister, where the moonlight could not fall, I seemed to see a dark figure. It was only the work of a moment more before he would spread his wings and reach me, and I was completely alone on the parapet. Suddenly I seemed to hear voices, agonizing voices in my own head that told me I could never overcome Dracula, that this was his world, not mine. They told me to jump while I was still myself, and I stood up like a person in a dream and jumped.
She sat very straight now, looking into the fire, and my father drew his hand over his face.
I wanted to fall free like Lucifer, like an angel. but I had not seen those rocks. I fell on them instead and cut my head and arms, but there was a large cushion of grass there too, and the fall did not kill me or break my bones. After some hours, I think, I woke to the cold night and felt blood seeping around my face and neck, and saw the moon setting and the drop below. My God, if I had rolled instead of fainting. I knew I could not explain to you what I had tried to do, and the shame of it came over me like a kind of madness. I felt I could never be worthy after that of you or our daughter. When I could stand, I got up, and I found that I had not bled so much. And although I was very sore, I had not broken anything, and I could feel that he had not swooped down upon me. He must have given me up for lost, too, when I jumped. I was terribly weak, and it was hard for me to walk, but I went around the monastery walls and down the road in the dark.
I thought my father might weep again, but he was quiet, his eyes never leaving hers.
I went out into the world. It was not so hard to do. When I needed money, I drew from our account in New York and put some in a Swiss bank. Then I left Switzerland as quickly as I could, in case you should try to trace me, Paul. Oh, forgive me.
She suddenly tightened her grip on my fingers, and I knew she meant her absence, not the money.
My father clenched his hands together.
That withdrawal gave me hope for a few months, or at least put a question into my mind, but my bank could not trace it.
Eventually I cut my hair short and colored it, changed my clothes, wore dark glasses. For a long time I stayed away from cities, and then I began little by little to go to the archives where I had always wanted to do my research. I tried to deduce from his movements where his new tomb was, where he had hidden himself after we opened his tomb at Sveti Georgi, but I couldn't discover any pattern. I thought that once I found him, once I killed him, I would come back and tell you how safe the world had become. I would earn you. I lived in fear that he would find me before I could find him, and everywhere I went I missed you. Oh, I was so lonely.
She picked up my hand again and caressed it like a fortune teller.
Finally, I thought that even if I was not worthy, I wanted to have just a glimpse of you, both of you. It was not hard to find you, or to sit in a cafe near your office, or to follow you on a trip or two, very carefully. Very, very carefully. I never let myself see either of you face to face, for fear you would see me. I came and went. If my research was going well, I allowed myself a visit to Amsterdam and followed you from there. Then one day, in Italy, at Monte Perdito, I saw him on the piazza. He was following you too, watching you in broad daylight. I could not decide what to do.
She looked at me for a moment, then she sighed.
For several years I had been writing postcards to you, my daughter, without sending them, of course. One day, I thought that I could communicate with the two of you from a distance, to let you know I was alive without letting anyone else see me. I sent them to Amsterdam, to your house, in a package addressed to Paul.
This time I turned to my father in amazement and anger.
Yes. I felt I could not show them to you, could not upset you without being able to find your mother for you. You can imagine what that period was like for me.
My father turned to Helen.
And I began looking for you, and for him.
She was gazing at him.
I saw I must give up my research and simply follow him, following you. Then you went to Oxford. In the library you left the book open.
He shut it when he saw me.
Well, the first time he looked at it, he forgot to close it.
You're right. Come to think of it, I did forget.
I think Master James must have seen it, too.
You know, I saw him in there just after we surprised you at your research, sir.
My father looked perplexed.
Yes. I'd left my Macintosh on the main floor of the library, and I went back for it less than an hour later. I saw Master James coming out of the niche in the balcony, but he didn't see me. I thought he looked awfully worried, sort of cross and distracted. I thought about that when I decided to call him, too.
You called Master James? I was surprised, but past feeling indignant. When? Why did you do that?
I called him from Paris because I remembered something.
Barley stretched his legs. I wanted to go over and twine my arm around his neck, but not in front of my parents. He looked at me.
I was trying to remember something. On the train. Something about Master James. And when we got to Paris, I remembered it. I'd seen a letter on his desk once when he was putting away some papers. An envelope, actually. And I liked the stamp on it. So I looked a little more closely. It was from Turkey. And it was old. That's what made me look at the stamp. Well, it was postmarked 20 years ago from a Professor Bora. And I thought to myself that I wanted to have a big desk someday and get letters from all over the world. The name Bora stuck with me. Even at the time, it sounded so exotic. Well, as we were getting off the train in Paris, I saw an old man on the platform. A Muslim, I guess. In a dark red hat with a long tassel. And I suddenly remembered that letter. Then your father's story hit me again. You know, the name of the Turkish professor. And I went to the phone. I realized Master James must still be in on this hunt in some way.
Where was I?
In the bathroom, I suppose. Girls were always in the bathroom.
He might as well have blown me a kiss, but not in front of the others.
Master James was livid with me on the phone. But when I told him what was going on, he said I was in his good graces forever. I didn't dare ask him what he meant to do. But now we know.
Yes, we do. He must have done the calculation from that old book, too, and figured out that it was 16 years to the week since Dracula's last visit to San Mateo. Then he'd certainly have realized where I was going.
There would be so much time to talk. I could see Helen was tired, that we were all tired to the bone, that we could not even begin to say to one another tonight what a triumph this had been. Was the world safer because we were all together, or because he was finally gone from it? I looked into a future I had never known about before. Helen would live with us and blow out the candles in the dining room. She would come to my graduation from high school and my first day at university and help me dress for my wedding, if I ever married. I could not know then that she would also drift from us at times, not speaking for hours, fingering her neck, or that a wasting illness would take her away for good 9 years later, long before we had gotten used to having her back. I couldn't foresee that our last gift would be knowing that she rested in peace when it could have been otherwise. If I had been able to foresee these things at all, I might have known that my father would disappear for a day after her funeral, and that the little dagger in our parlor cabinet would go with him, and that I would never, never ask him about it. But the future began a few minutes later, when my father reached out, smiling at all of us, and drew Helen to her feet.
Come. Come to bed.
A couple of years ago, a strange opportunity presented itself to me while I was in Philadelphia for a conference, an international gathering of medieval historians. During our few hours of leisure, I slipped away from the endless talk of Byzantine artifacts to see some real ones in the magnificent art museum. There, I picked up a pamphlet for a small literary museum and library downtown, whose name I'd heard years before from my father, and whose collection I had reason to know about. It was an important site for Dracula scholars. There, I recalled, a researcher might see Bram Stoker's Notes for Dracula, culled from sources at the British Library, and an important medieval pamphlet as well. My father had always wanted to visit this collection. I would spend an hour there for his sake. He had been killed by a landmine in Sarajevo more than 10 years before, working to mediate Europe's worst conflagration in decades. I still missed him hourly. That was how I came to find myself in a small climate-controlled room in one of the city's 19th-century brownstones, handling documents that breathed not only a distant past, but also the urgency of my father's researches. When I had settled myself with a notebook and a light sweater against the air conditioning, the librarian brought me first Stoker's papers, and then a small cardboard box bound with ribbon. Stoker's notes were a pleasant diversion, a study in chaotic note-taking. Some were written in a cramped hand, some typed on ancient onion skin. Among them lay newspaper clippings about mysterious events and leaves from his personal calendar. I thought how my father would have enjoyed this, how he would have smiled over Stoker's innocent dabbling in the occult. But after half an hour, I put them carefully aside and turned to the other box. It held one slim volume, bound in a neat, probably 19th century cover, 40 pages printed on nearly unblemished 15th century parchment, a medieval treasure, a miracle of movable type. It was a pamphlet from Nuremberg, printed in 1510, and it told of Dracul Vida's crimes, his cruelty, his bloodthirsty feasts. I could make out from their familiarity to me the first lines of the medieval German. In the year of our Lord 1462, Dracula did many strange and terrible things. The library had provided a translation sheet, in fact, and there I reread with a shudder some of Dracula's crimes against humanity. I collected my belongings then, with a feeling of pilgrimage completed, and thanked the kind librarian. I went downstairs to the gift shop, and from there out to the warm street. The very contrast between the purified air inside the museum and the bustle of the city outside made the oak door behind me look forbiddingly sealed, so that it startled me all the more to see the librarian hurrying out of it. She gave me the self-conscious smile of one who returns to you a treasure. Wouldn't want to lose this, your wallet, your keys, a fine bracelet. I thanked her and took the book and notebook she handed me. She disappeared into the old building as quickly as she'd descended on me. The notebook was mine, certainly, although I'd thought I'd packed it safely in my briefcase before leaving. The book was... I can't say now what I actually thought it was in that first moment, only that the cover was a rubbed old velvet, very, very old, and that it was both familiar and unfamiliar under my hand. The parchment inside had none of the freshness of the pamphlet I'd examined in the library. Despite the emptiness of its pages, it reeked of centuries of handling. The ferocious single image at the center was open in my hand before I could stop myself, closed again before I could look at it long. In my hotel room, I set my book on the glass-top table and washed my face and hands. Then I went to the windows and stood looking out over the city. Down the block I could see the patrician ugliness of the Philadelphia City Hall with its statue of peace-loving William Penn balanced on top. From here the parks were green squares of treetops. Light glanced off the bank towers. Far to my left I could see the federal building that had been bombed a month before, and could hear the roar of rebuilding. But it was not this scene that filled my gaze. I was imagining a clear autumn morning in 1476, a morning just cool enough to make mist rise from the surface of the lake. A boat runs aground at the edge of the island below the walls and domes with their iron crosses. The man who steps out of it is alone, and the feet he sets on the stone embankment are clad in finely made boots of red leather. He is dressed in purple and red damask under a long black velvet cloak, which is pinned across his broad chest with an elaborate brooch. The abbot has been notified already and hurries to meet him under the trees, extending his hand.
We are honored, Lord.
Dracula kisses his ring, and the abbot makes the sign of the cross over him.
We thought the worst when you did not come in the spring. God be praised.
Dracula smiles, but says nothing, giving the abbot a long look. The abbot is particularly concerned that his patron be given the last rites when the moment comes, although he is afraid to tell him so. He hopes Dracula will not bring up the subject of paradise, and is relieved when the prince asks to see what progress they have made in his absence. They walk together around the edge of the monastery courtyard, the chickens scattering before them. Dracula surveys the newly completed buildings and the lustily sprouting vegetable gardens with a look of satisfaction, and the abbot hastens to show him the walkways they have built since his last visit. In the abbot's chamber, they drink tea, and then Dracula sets a velvet bag before the abbot.
We will furnish the sacristy and put in a new baptismal font. I want you to order artisans from wherever you want. This will easily pay for it, with enough left over for my grave.
Your grave, my lord?
Yes, Eminence.
His hand goes to his sword hilt again.
I have been thinking about it, and I would like to be placed before the altar, with a marble stone above. I want my portrait painted on the gravestone, but no cross.
No cross, my lord?
No cross.
But every grave is marked with the suffering of our Savior, and yours must have the same honor.
Dracula's face darkens.
I do not plan to subject myself long to death.
There is only one way in which to escape death, and that is through the Redeemer, if he grants us his grace.
Dracula stares at him for a few minutes, and the abbot tries not to look away.
Perhaps. But recently I met a man, a merchant who has traveled to a monastery in the West. He said there is a place in Gaul, the oldest church in their part of the world, where some of the Latin monks have outwitted death by secret means. He offered to sell me their secrets, which he has inscribed in a book.
God preserve us from such heresies. I am certain, my son, that you refuse this temptation.
You know, I am fond of books.
There is only one true book, and that is the one we must love with all our hearts and all our souls.
Come.
To the abbot's relief, Dracula has apparently tired of this debate, and he stands up suddenly, vigorously.
I want to see your scribes. I will have a special job for them soon.
They go together into the tiny scriptorium, where three of the monks sit copying manuscripts according to the old way, and one carves letters to print a page of the life of St. Anthony. The press itself stands in one corner. It is the first printing press in Wallachia, and Dracula runs a proud hand over it. A heavy, square hand.
I have a special commission for you. I shall leave a sketch for it with the Lord Abbot.
In the sunshine of the courtyard, he pauses.
I will stay for the service and take communion with you. Do you have a bed for me in one of the cells tonight?
As always, my lord. This house of God is your home.
And now, let us go up in my tower.
The abbot knows well this practice of his patron. Dracula always likes to survey the lake and surrounding shores from the highest point in the church, as if to check for enemies. The dome of the tower has long openings on every side. When the abbot reaches the top, Dracula is already standing at his favorite post, staring across the water, his hands clasped behind him in a characteristic gesture of thought, of planning. The abbot has seen him stand this way in front of his warriors, directing the strategy for the next day's raid. He looks not at all like a man in constant peril, a leader whose death could occur at any hour, who should be pondering every moment the question of his salvation. He looks instead, the abbot thinks, as if all the world is before him.
This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks production of The Historian, written by Elizabeth Kostova, and read by Joanne Wally, Martin Jarvis, Dennis Boutsakaris, Jim Ward, Rosalind Landor, and Robin Atkin Downs. Executive Producer Maya Thomas. Produced and directed by Arthur G. Insana. Senior Producer Linda Ross Korn. Abridged for audio by Andrew Loschert. Engineered by Craig Sadler at the Media Staff, Los Angeles, California. Mixed and mastered by John Kovarik. The Historian is also available in hardcover from Little Brown and Company. To listen to samples or read more about the author, please visit Time Warner Audiobooks' website at twbookmark.com/audiobooks. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.